Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Welcome to the Fish Nerds, a show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. I'm Clay Groves, Chief Executive Fish Nerd of the Fish Nerds Podcast, licensed fishing guide, and I'm super happy to be here. Today on the show, you're going to love this. We have Isaac Daly, known as Shrek, from the Noob Spiro Podcast, a podcast that shows interesting spearfishing expert authorities and characters from all over the world. They dial in on the experiences and wisdom from a diverse bunch of Spiros from all over the globe. They are not flat earthers. From the spearfishing in the cold waters of the North Sea and Arctic to the clear, the tropical waters, a lot of words here, in the Great Barrier Reef. We find Spiros with tips to help improve your spearfishing. Listen to into Isaac, Shrek Daly, and Levi Turbo Brown on the Noob Spiro Podcast for free at noobspiro.com. Shrek, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Clay. I don't think my podcast description rolls off the tongue as nicely as yours does. In fact, you said eating fish, I started salivating. So yours was already much more appealing.
I imagine with spearfishing, there's not a lot of catch and releasing.
No, there's zero. So you've got to be very selective. And it does make for sometimes going home with empty hands. That's for sure, because you just haven't got that fish you wanted for the day.
All right. Well, so Shrek, you're going to be co-hosting today, and on the show today, we're going to talk a little bit about spearfishing. I have a lot of questions. You have a Kickstarter going on where you're putting out a new book, which you've graciously sent me a copy, and I just got 10 minutes ago, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet, although I've looked at the pictures. It's very pretty. We're going to talk about how people can get started in spearfishing, some top tips for people. If we have time, we're going to do the news, and I have a quiz for you because I want to test your worldwide fishy knowledge. So lots going on.
This is what I was afraid of.
Yeah, and so you're a spearfisher, and for those who don't know, spearfishing is almost like it's like you're in the ocean with spears swimming around, and it must be dangerous. And so you must have life insurance.
No, I don't. But tell me about Health IQ.
Oh, I'm glad you asked. So the reason I'm saying that is because we are sponsored by Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, strength trainers, vegans, and more. Maybe even spearfishers. I'm not sure. 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4% and 33% on their life insurance. Just like if you drive your car well, you save money on your car insurance. If you live a healthy life, you can save money on your life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/FNP, healthiq.com/FNP. Take a quiz and see if you qualify to save money on your life insurance. Whew, good.
Sounds like a good deal.
It's a good deal, and we can, just try it out and see what happens. But hey, let's talk about spearfishing, because I'm really interested in this. Now, I live in New Hampshire in the United States, and you're in China right now.
Yeah, I am in China. I've been here for nearly a year now teaching English. I've had a little bit of a break away from Australia, and I come from New Zealand originally, where it all began in the water for me. Moved to Australia in my early 20s, and now I'm in China for a year. And not long now, though, I'll be headed back to Australia and probably New Zealand as well. And because I've been really, really missing my spearfishing here, the water is like brown, cold, and the fish they seem to catch here are just tiny. Not great fun.
There's a lot of people in China. Maybe they ate all the big ones. Have you eaten any bizarre fish while you've been in China? I know like different cultures have different, they eat the heads or different parts of the body that we, I don't want to say Westerners, but Southerners or whatever you're from, maybe don't eat back home.
One of the best and worst things about living in China is they don't speak a lot of English when you get away from the major cities. So they'll tell you the name of a fish, but really you don't know what you're eating. One of my favorite dishes here is like swan sai yu, which I found out is like a small catfish from muddy rivers that are often polluted. So just tells you how far off my taste buds are with the Chinese spices.
But, oh, man.
I think I've had the puffer fish that blow up.
The one that kills you?
Yeah. I was recently over in Japan for 8 days as well, and they were serving it up there, but I didn't actually get to try it there. But I'm pretty sure I've eaten it here in China.
Puffer, oh my God. And you didn't die?
No, they're pretty good at, like, the guy, well, I don't know about the guys in China, but the guys in Japan go through, like, a rigorous, like, apprenticeship where they really get taught how to do this thing. And they I don't think anyone's died from eating one for quite a while. I mean, if you're doing it at home, it's probably not a DIY fish. You've got to get some formal training to kind of take out and make sure you don't poison yourself. But
right, because they've got a bacteria called tetrodotoxin, right? And that's what
exactly
gets you.
Right.
That's dangerous stuff. So yeah, well, so don't eat puffer fish without an expert. But enjoying China, you're teaching English there. You know, I thought about traveling and teaching English because being a native speaker, I always thought it'd be fun to like travel the world and do it. Are you enjoying it?
It has been really fun. But like you sort of said, like China's, you know, the way things are here, it's still very much a developing country. So, you know, there's a lot of pollution in the waterways, which is a little bit depressing to see when you're a waterman. And when you like your fishing, it's kind of like a little bit off-putting. But in terms of like culture, lifestyle, language and food, amazing place. But for fishing, pow.
So you can't wait to get back into some good waters,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, hey, so you spearfish, and this is new for me. Like New Hampshire, the only kind of spearfishing we do is in rivers during the spawning sucker runs. And so it's not the same as what you're doing. We're not snorkeling or we're not diving. We're just throwing spears in the water. We also can shoot them with a bow and arrow with a string attached, the cord attached.
I've seen that. That looks cool.
Yeah, and in some parts in the United States, there's a lot of, we do spearfishing on the coast, people do that, but on the inland waters, and we have a lot of inland waters, people do ice fishing, spearing for like northern pike and that sort of thing. So that's a very different kind of spearing than you're doing. You're free diving with spear guns, right?
Yeah, that's true. Some parts of the world, and I was listening to one of your episodes the other day, you had a woman on that does it on scuba, and I started off that way in New Zealand, but it's kind of like the freedive spearfishing community are kind of like, they write off scuba dive spearfishing, but I have a different idea about it. But yeah, no, we do it fully on one breath of air, and people think it's more challenging and more sporting. I don't know about that. I think some parts of the world, like in Canada where they do it and where it's really super cold, I can understand why guys are doing it on scuba, because it's just too difficult with all the amount of wetsuit you've got on and stuff like that. You really got to get down quite deep and it's dark, and so you need scuba, I think. But we practice definitely breath hold spearfishing, so it's very challenging and a lot of things to learn, super steep learning curve. And like you sort of alluded to, it's not super safe sometimes, so you got to learn about the risk and put different things in place to sort of manage that risk. But I think partly because of that, it's really, really enjoyable. And I was never that guy that could sit on the boat and just line fish. I always wanted to get in the water and see everything. So
yeah, I've had that urge. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was shark fishing and we had a chum slick and tons of little fish in the slick. And I just knew there was something big hiding in there. And I just knew if I jumped in the water, I'd get to see it. But the captain of the boat wouldn't let me put my snorkel on and go because of the Mako's. And he was concerned about my safety. So in spearfishing, have you ever come across a fish that would, you know, could eat you?
Oh, yeah. In Australia, when you're spearfishing.
Australia.
You know, and even New Zealand. You know, you're always kind of seeing sharks. In New Zealand, it's bronze whalers. You know, if you're in the Pacific, in any of the Pacific Islands, it's, you know, a lot of reef sharks. Occasionally you get oceanic hammerheads and they come in for a look. New Zealand also get the occasional Mako. And in Australia, you've got a lot of bull sharks. And I'm not quite sure. It's some type of whaler shark that we get in Brisbane where I was. And quite often we'll see tiger sharks and occasionally the even the odd great white. So we kind of get to see it all. I haven't personally seen a great white, but I've dove with 15-foot tiger sharks and numerous bull sharks and whalers, so, and lots of reef sharks. And, I mean, it's definitely kind of a learning curve, getting used to, you know, reading their body language and making sure that you're using the correct body language to kind of deter any interactions. But bad things still do happen, so it's part of the sport.
Right, but it doesn't happen often enough to deter you. Like, it's not that common, really, when you consider how many interactions people have with sharks versus how many people get attacked.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, most of the time, sharks are super chilled. You know,
I've never heard anyone say sharks are super chill.
No, they really, they are. And like, spearfishermen have got, you know, there's kind of, you get negative raps. I mean, the media will get hold of a picture of a spearfisherman poking a shark, but that's just like one of the strategies we'll use to deter them. And like a spear gun shaft, when you push a shark, it's so big, you don't even break their skin. So really, you're just sending them a message like, okay, don't come near me, I'm also in the ocean and I've got something that can poke you, so there's easier meals elsewhere. But honestly, I don't even think they're really interested in eating us. It's more of a competition type mentality. Occasionally, when you have shot a fish and it's around, it's still alive on the end of your line, you'll get sharks coming and they'll go for it, and then it does really become a competition. But like you say, it doesn't happen super often. But you know, definitely in the waters of Brisbane, you need to learn how to get used to diving with them and kind of what to do, and you need to know when it's time to get out of the water and move somewhere else.
Right on. Well, hey, well, let's jump into your book. You've written a book called 99 Tips to Get Better at Spearfishing. And right now, people can go to Kickstarter.com, and I'll put a link up at fishnerds.com so they can get to it and to support the book. This is already available on Amazon, but you've kind of rebuilt this book as a Kickstarter project. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, cool. So, I mean, we interview spearfishing experts and, you know, people from all over the world every other day. And part of the reason Levi and I started, you know, the spearfishing podcast and blog was really because when we got started, there was not a lot of information around. It was very piecemeal and difficult to get hold of the right information. And there's a very steep learning curve. You know, you got holding your breath, you know, dealing with sharks. The equipment, there's a big learning curve. I remember struggling with, you know, I mean, even what type of snorkel to buy. I mean, it just seems like a simple bit of kit, but, you know, the more you know, the kind of the less you know. And even finding a buddy, you know, like spearfishing, you really need to have good people around you that know what they're doing. So finding a buddy, no one wants to go with an inexperienced guy. So we started the new Sparrow with that in mind and really got interviewing all these guys. And one thing we realized is a lot of people just consume, you know, huge amounts of information, but they really don't get much out of it. So our book's like, it's not real long. We've just kind of tried to boil big bits of advice down into an actionable sort of tip. So just guys can implement it into their spearfishing straight away, because it's still a learn by doing sport. But hopefully, like, the book will give people some information to slowly integrate and improve their diving practice overall.
Yeah, looking through the book right now, first of all, it's beautiful. The photos are unreal. They're just, make you want to get in the water. It's like a beautiful magazine. And what I'm liking, just the quick, this is my first impression. I like that you've got 99 tips, but each tip isn't like four pages of filler. They get right to it. The tip comes up, like, for example, tip number 12, increasing bottom time, and right away it jumps into like one paragraph with the tip, and then it moves on to number 13. It just goes one to the next, and you organize them in a way that makes sense. Be a great bathroom reader, and even if people aren't spearfishers, just the underwater photography in here is stunning. Yeah. Who took the photos?
Oh, we've built a kind of a network and relationships with some of the best underwater photographers, you know, in the spearfishing world. So they kindly sort of donated their works to us. Jesse Cripps and Michael Takash from Underwater Ally Productions are a couple of the guys. Ted Hardy from Immersion Freediving in America. We've had David Ochoa from, he's got his own film production studio. Some of these guys, their photography is phenomenal and not enough people kind of get to see it. So it was great to actually be able to use it and put it in our book and, you know, make it so visually appealing to people. One thing I will say, you know, you said our information was kind of like, you know, one paragraph and it's kind of succinct advice. We actually tried to do that because, like, you can read, you can read and read and read and get nothing out of it. You know, like, it's, you don't get anything to take away. We try to make it, like I say, I use this word actionable to describe it, but guys also don't really want to read a lot. They'd rather look at a picture and then mm-hmm. think about an idea and go away. And like you say, like you said it like humorously about reading it on the bathroom, but I think that's actually probably one of the better places to read it, because really just read one tip, digest it, try and apply it to your spearfishing. That's all we really wanted.
Yeah, and you don't have to. It's not a narrative. You don't have to read it in order. You can flip.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to read about free diving, so I'm going to go to tip number 44 or whatever it happens to be. You just go to that. You go to that section, which is great, and it's really beautiful. And congratulations. So, like I said, you put this out already on Amazon, but now you're redoing it on Kickstarter. Tell us why you are reissuing this on Kickstarter. What's going on?
So the first version was very much just a stripped down, just the information. There's no pictures in our Amazon version.
Well, that
this
sucks.
Version, like, yeah. Well, a lot of guys still want a paper book, and I mean, spearfishing is a very visual sport. So you just give guys a book to read with no pictures. They kind of like, where's the pictures at, man?
And, that's right.
So we did it. We went through our book. We re-edited it, and the more you write something, the kind of the better you get at it. So we found ways to say things in a different way, and pictures to match. So yeah, that's kind of what it's about. And we just wanted to fund a big print run, because far out, it's such a mission. Shipping and physical products everywhere these days, it's so costly and difficult to organize. And you know, we're not like some huge corporation. We're just a couple of blokes that wrote a book. So
that's you're not a huge corporation yet, but once this book becomes a bestseller, look out. Well, Spiro will be on everyone's lips.
Yeah, thanks to guys like you that got on and backed it. You know, we're actually doing pretty well. It's just gone over the 50% mark. I've been hitting refresh on my Kickstarter page all day, and thank you for getting on, Clay. I really appreciate your support. I'll have to get on and return serve on your Patreon page.
Sure. Well, it's Fish Nerd's policy. This is actually I run the whole show here, but it's our policy, my policy, to if I have someone running a Kickstarter campaign on my show, it's because I like what they're doing, and I always back every project I have on the show. So if I have it on the show, I'm going to back it. I'm not going to just talk about it. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And it's really important. This whole crowdfunding thing is so important, because this is the real, like, people doing real work. And so if you're not already following along, I always follow Kickstarter, and I just search for fishing every couple of weeks. And I try to support these people, just like I want. Just like you said, it's not big corporations. This is just a person doing a project, making art, and this is where the real art's happening now. And this is how we support it. So put the money in the hat.
Yeah, no, and like Fish Nerds is very much like Noob Spiro. You know, you serve a passionate audience of Spiros, of fishermen, people that are interested in, you know, the marine environment, and I very much appreciate what you said. And it's cool. Kickstarter is great for this. I love the fact that it's this platform that allows people to do that, and you don't have to be in a big company anymore. You can just bring your crowd, and away you go. So I really like Kickstarter in terms of that.
That's beautiful. So you built it yourself, you own it, and it's yours, and it's great. So, hey, let me ask you, first of all, what is a noob? And like, for those of us who don't speak Australian or New Zealand, and what does noob mean?
Noob come from, I believe, the British Navy. It comes from newbie. And then it was shortened to noob. And by the time it made it to online games and first-person shooter computer games, people couldn't spell N-E-W-B. So it just changed to noob, like it sort of sounds. And so now it's noob. And so we got hold of that language. And part of the reason why we call it Noob Spiro is we really wanted to pull the ego out of spearfishing, because sometimes, you know, there are egotistical people that like to hold up big fish and, you know, talk about how strong they are, I guess. But so part of the Noob Spiro thing, like with guys that are getting started, you really don't want them to get hold of a big ego straight away. So we called ourselves the Noob Spiro to kind of, you know, take the mickey out of ourselves, I guess, and keep it kind of low key. So it's very much a funny kind of thing for us. And Spiro is just like, you know, spear fisherman just sounds ponderous. It's too long. Mm-hmm. So people nowadays call themselves Spiros or Spira if you're a girl. So
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So Noob Spiro, that's where it comes.
Hey, so you're from New Zealand, but through Australia.
Yeah.
What part of Australia?
Yeah, Brisbane in Queensland on the east coast there, and it's a beautiful part of the world because we've kind of got, you get the tropical fish and the coral reef, mm-hmm. but then you get some of the really nice tasting southern species that come up in the colder water. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. The diving is challenging though. A lot of the spearfishing is, you know, 60 foot plus.
Oh, forget it. And I'm out.
Yeah. And so like when you're learning, you're just like, man, I really just want to find a place where I can even get down to the bottom. And so it's a tough place to learn, but a great place to go spearfishing, that's for sure.
Yeah. So we have Fish Nerds correspondents, people who work on our show all over the world. And we have a correspondent called Luke Chammings, and he's from Adelaide, Australia. And he fishes the Murray River for Murray Cod. He's a lure maker. He owns Shamo's Lures. I'm going to connect you guys because maybe you could pull some, when you get back to Australia, maybe you could pull a story together with him. He's great.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Complete fish nerd. And again, he makes handmade lures really beautiful. And he fishes with a guy named Captain Spiro.
Okay.
But they fish out of a tin boat. They don't dive. So it's strange little world. But so when you said Spiro, I'm like, it must mean something different. I don't know. But it doesn't. It means what it means.
News, fish in the news. Everybody loves their fish in the news.
All right. Hey, want to do some news?
Yeah. Let's do it.
All right, let's jump in. And you brought news with you today.
I did. There was a wicked article published, so I wanted to talk a bit about it.
Why don't you take the lead then on it, and I'll jump in.
Legend, I mean, I think you actually found the news too. So it was published on theinertia.com, and one of the McNulty brothers published a fantastic article on there. His name's Rhett. There's actually three of these brothers, or there was. One of them died, I believe.
Do you know them?
I know one of them. I know Clark, and I think he's the older brother. He worked in Brisbane briefly, so I had a few good chats with him. Mm-hmm. And passionate fisher, or the whole family is, passionate waterman in general. And I like this article because it's kind of like, you know, pointing towards where spearfishing's going more than where it's, more than kind of where it's been. And I like this competition they're talking about, the Kirk McNulty White Sea Bass competition. It's more about, repopulating the white sea bass population over there. And for every entry into the competition, two white sea bass, are released back into the ocean. So that's pretty cool.
So the headline is how spearfishing evolved from hunting to a sport, leading the conservation of marine environments. And that's kind of get you there.
What was your take on it?
I haven't read it yet. For those who are listening, it was 3 hours ago. I was just waking up, and I don't know what time it was in China, but 3 hours ago we were talking, and you're like, I got this Kickstarter thing going on. I can get on today. I'm like, okay, as fast as I can. Here's some show notes. Here's some news. Let's jump in. And so I actually didn't do my homework on this. That's why I was hoping you would lead it, and I could just jump in after.
I love your spontaneity. I think what I got from the article was it's kind of like, you know, there's a shift in the general attitude. These guys are far more proactive. Look, competitions, spearfishing competitions and initiatives are popping up all over the place that are really kind of partnering with, you know, different agencies to have good conservation outcomes. This Kirk McNulty White Sea Bass competition is one example. In New Zealand, they've got the biggest lake in New Zealand. They have a problem with invasive bloody catfish.
Oh, what kinds?
Bullnose.
Okay.
Bullnose. So they're not a real big fish, but every year they have an annual catfish cull in this Lake Taupo. And one of my friends actually helped to organize it, and he's actually, well, this year he didn't win it, he was very angry, but we're seeing these kind of competitions pop up everywhere. And down in New South Wales, the competitions that they have there annually, they share the data with the government agencies, and it gives them, you know, a really good set of data to make more informed decisions about, you know, fishing species closures and things like that. So I really like this article, and I like what it's pointing to. So
yeah, and there's a lot of people don't realize the connection between people who fish and hunt and conservation efforts. Like most fishers, most hunters have a conservation mindset. They want the stuff to go forward, and you know, not just the work they're doing like with stuff like this, but their fees that they spend on their hunting and fishing equipment, a lot of that goes to conservation efforts. So they're usually meeting it, you know, in different areas as well. So yeah. I love it. I love that they're doing the thing. I also like that it's bringing attention to spearfishing as a sport, not just as a hunt. And it's kind of interesting. And for me, this is all brand new. I never give any real thought to spearfishing. So I am such a noob.
A couple of episodes, I was listening to Fish Nerds, and I think it was a couple of episodes, maybe it was one episode ago, and you and your daughter Zoe were chatting about fishing spawns, and you were going to do one species a week. I thought that was a fantastic conversation to have as well, because there is kind of like an ethical responsibility towards, you know, just thinking and planning about how you fish. And it just, like, the thing I like about your show is I think it's raising that awareness. People are thinking far more about their environment and the impact they're having, so it's cool.
Yeah, that's how we keep it. So yeah, great stuff, really cool. And So when you're spearfishing, I know on the East Coast of the United States, a lot of spearfishing for lionfish, invasive lionfish, has become very, very popular.
Yeah, yeah.
And collecting them. But it allows you to be like really selective of species. Like, do you have like catch limits, slot limits, and size restrictions on the spearfishing? And how do you be sure you're catching the right size fishes?
So fisheries management in Australia is pretty piecemeal. It's run on a state-by-state basis. So you've really got to kind of be informed, you know, through various government departments. The laws change, the licensing changes. In Queensland, you don't need a license. In New South Wales, which is just over the border, you do, and you pay for that. And because you pay for it, they seem to have a lot more publications available for recreational fishermen. But no, it's very much kind of finding out as you go, which is not a really good way to learn. But yeah, what's your management like in the US? Is it the same? Is it state by state?
So there's federally protected fishes. So there's some fish that the whole country just says, oh, nope, you can't fish for those. Those are endangered. But then everything else is state by state, and then the states don't always agree. So like in New Hampshire, where I live, we border Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts, and Canada. And so then there are rivers, like the most noticeable one is a river between New Hampshire and Maine. And New Hampshire and Vermont. And New Hampshire and Vermont have to get together and discuss interstate water restrictions, because Vermont doesn't agree with new biologists, don't agree with New Hampshire biologists on the best management practices.
Yeah.
And so there's that debate. So when you're fishing those waters, you have to like really almost be a lawyer to figure out what you're allowed to catch. You know, they have slot limits on the fish. So like if you catch a walleye, for example, that's between 15 and 18 inches, you can keep it. If it's between 18 and 24, you can't. Above 24, you can. Below 6, I mean, there's all these like, and then if it's the third Monday of the equinox, you can't touch the fishes, and there's just all these rules. So it gets heavy and confusing.
Are the recreational fishermen part of that kind of that management approach there?
Yes. Well, we do a lot of, we're part of it in that they consider our points of view at the hearings and stuff. But I don't know how much data is collected from recreational fishers. I don't submit any data. And I'm a guide. I'm fishing every day. And I'm not giving much information to them. Although I do go to hearings and give my opinion on things. Yeah. Which is usually my opinion is less anglers agree with me than biologists, because I'm usually I'm pretty hard on the conservation side of things. I'm pretty supportive of most, but when if a biologist says these numbers are low, I'm like, okay, don't catch them. And then the other guys are like, but I want to catch them and I want to use lead and I want to kill things. You know, I'm like, well, it's, you know, kill something else, you know?
Yeah, so we have disagreements. And, I think that's a good approach to err on the side of caution. Do you guys have a lot of citizen science or like around the management of your fisheries?
You get that in the ocean. So the cod fishery, which has been collapsed in the last few years, the boat captains do a lot of tracking of numbers there and work with scientists to try to get data for them. And then there's a lot of fishing groups out in the ocean who will fish for rough species and share that data with the scientists. And they try to all work together. It's not, they don't always agree. As you imagine, like money drives a lot of things. So if you're a commercial fisherman or you fish for, you know, for a living, and the conservation biologists are saying, maybe you shouldn't eat codfish anymore. There's a big problem, between the two groups. And that's the hardest thing.
I can understand too. Like, yeah, from both perspectives. And
well, the hardest thing is, so we have actually one of my correspondents in the show is a shark and cod fisherman.
Okay.
And but it's his living, okay, right? And he's doing everything within the law. So it's tricky when the laws don't match, you know, what you know about conservation efforts. And he's also a cod fisherman, and not commercial. He is like a charter captain. And so the cod fishery is shut down even for charter captains. So I went out with him this spring to go fishing for pollock, which are in the cod family. And we caught cod everywhere we stopped. Giant, wow. not giant cod, but they were all like, you know, three, wow, 4 feet long, big fish. Mm-hmm. Really fun to catch. And we couldn't stop catching them. And it was almost like they become a hassle. And for him, that was very frustrating because he's trying to make a living. He's got clients in the boat who aren't catching fish they can take home with them. And he's saying the cod fishery is no good, but all we're catching is codfish. So that kind of like visual differentiation between what we're seeing on the water and what the scientists say are happening. What we're seeing is a conservation win. We're seeing the cod coming back. Yeah. And so he's thinking, cod are back, let's go catch them. And yeah, I'm thinking, those are still historically small cod. And if we give a few more years, we're going to have big numbers of cod. So let's keep catching pollock. But I can see the problem. Like it's a big push-pull, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's good to see there's some interaction. I mean, like recreational fishermen, I mean, do you keep a fishing log?
Say it again.
Do you keep a fishing log?
If I was smart, I would. But I do not keep a fishing log. Well, you know what it is because I'm writing all the time and I'm blogging and I'm making the podcast. My work is my fishing log, but it's not accurate. Yeah. It's not good. You couldn't rely on it. But yeah, I don't. Do you?
No, I'm in the process of doing it. I mean, we've talked to so many guys that do it, and they just swear by it because, you know, you get to replicate results and you can see how the weather and, you know, pressure systems. You're good?
I'm good. Yep.
You can, and the moon phases affect your local fishery, and you can sort of notice trends and study them over time, you know, just like scientists do, I guess. But I think sometimes recreational fishermen are a better place to do it than scientists are, because, well, number one, we're freediving, so like we don't have copious amounts of bubbles pouring out the side of us either, so we don't scare away everything in a 20 meter radius. So sometimes we seem to see more or different things than people on scuba do. So,
but yeah,
I'm betting assignments for what you're doing.
we're going to run over each other. It's important that, like you said, I think you're saying is I think all information is valuable. And I think the better data you keep, the more help you are the scientist, and you can meet somewhere in the middle with all that stuff. So
in the middle.
By the way, your book says keep a fishing log, and you're not doing it. So shame on you.
I haven't been spearfishing since last year, actually. So, but when I do go for the next one, I will log it. I should have brought that practice along with me. You're right. Thank you.
Well, you know, maybe I'll start logging my open. I'm ice fishing. I'm on the ice still for another month. But once the ice melts, maybe I will start logging my freshwater fishing trips. I just bought a new boat, and so maybe I'll keep good track of all the fish we catch, where we catch them, moon phases, pressure systems, temperature, all that
stuff. I'll send you a free copy of our spearfishing log. You might just have to tailor it a little bit for what you're doing.
Or maybe I got to go and spearfish illegally in New Hampshire. So, although we do have coastal spearfishing, we have listeners who do spearfish. Michael Crooker is one of our supporters, and he spearfishes in New Hampshire for striped bass. So,
okay.
Yeah, we do have listeners who do it, and they're going to love hearing about you, which is great. And they'll probably give you some money, which is even better. Hey, let's talk about diving in Antarctica. What to wear in polar conditions. Have you ever dove in Antarctica?
No, the closest I've gone is underwater caves down sort of the top of the South Island in New Zealand, and that was bad enough, but that water there was only 8 or 9 degrees. These guys are diving in like, it can get -2 sometimes without freezing.
Oh, because salt, right? The salinity makes it doesn't freeze. That's crazy. So you've dove in that, and this is an article from Jonathan Sucks. It's jonathansunix.com. And we'll put links up at fishnerds.com. You sent this to me, I believe. Yeah. So when you're diving in cold water, what's your trick for keeping warm? Because I'm going to tell you, I'm an ice fishing person. I live on top of the ice, but we don't get wet. And so we don't, even though we might be fishing in minus 27, we're not wet in minus 27. So you guys are wet and in cold weather. Tell me about how do you get ready for that?
I mean, like in your part of the world, they wear dry suits, some of the guys on scuba. So,
yeah.
You know, you are actually dry. You can wear your clothes under one of those suits. It's pretty bulky.
Yeah.
You feel like the Michelin man. But nevertheless, it's a comfortable, warm way to do it. Some of them have even got warm air rebreathers in them. So, pretty comfortable. The new suits we're all wearing now, we're sport compared to guys 20 years ago. We've got these open cell wetsuits. You can wear a much thinner suit. And a wetsuit works on the principle that a very thin layer of water circulates around your body within the suit, and that, you know, holds your body temperature or fairly close to it. So you know, you do adapt your thickness. But this guy was traveling to Antarctica in I believe a 7mm suit. Mm-hmm. And he was fine, apart from his face, which he said froze off and went numb in 5 minutes.
Of course it did.
But the leaps forward in gear, we're pretty sport these days, I think.
Yeah, technology is so cool. And coming in the future, who knows what they're going to come up with as this sports grow and people have more money somehow to buy all the gear and buy better technology. Have you ever been so cold like you thought you were going to die when spear fishing?
No. If you stay hydrated, generally, you know, a couple of hours out in the water. If you're cold, you head back to the boat or the shore and warm back up again. No, I haven't really. Like I said, diving in caves, the Ruoka cave system, the top of the South Island in New Zealand, you dive sort of 100 meters into this hill, and then you get out and you take all your gear off and you go for a bit of a walk. That was freezing. That was terrible. I had an old school closed cell suit. Normal neoprene. It was almost like a surfing wetsuit, and I was freezing then. That's probably the coldest I've ever been. That was like, you know, your head goes underwater, you've got a headache. So,
and have you had, because when I'm ice fishing and we're taking photos on the ice, we notice that our equipment fails constantly.
Yeah.
So when you're underwater, do you find your equipment fails more? Is it not a problem because it's warmer, because it can't get, you know, too far below freezing?
Well, yeah, it's spot on. Like, if you're on scuba, you have problems with your regulators, the diaphragm and stuff like that freezing up. But mostly for free diving or free dive, you know, breath hold spearfishing, you might have a dive watch. And so the batteries, you know, the batteries do not like the cold. So they definitely, you know, your battery goes from hero to zero in a matter of minutes, it seems at times. And a little bit like when you're going to record a podcast interview.
we have that happen with iPhones. You know, we're on the ice taking photos, and when it's super cold, they just turn off. They just,
yeah.
And we tape hot pads to the back of them to keep them from freezing on the ice.
That's awful too, if you're like catch and release, because the only thing you would have had was a photo.
That's it. But now I've got ice shanties on the lake with heaters in them and solar panels and chargers and all the things we need. So we like to be comfortable. We don't want to be in pain. You know,
part of fishing for all of us, I think, is about relaxation. You know,
sure.
For me, like being face down on the surface of the ocean and looking down, even if I'm not spearing something, is just really relaxing. And I know I've got good mates that do pole fishing, line fishing, and they love it for the same reasons. It's just a bit of a getaway from our modern sort of breakneck speed lives, I think.
Well, I saw a guy on Facebook the other day, and I'm going to try and get him on the show here. And he likes to swim with shad during the spring migration. And he has a football helmet with a full-on fishing rod attached to it. And he has a GoPro on there, and he swims in the schools of shad fishing while he's swimming with the fish. Which I think is remarkable. I can't wait to get him on, because he doesn't look like he's relaxing. He looks like he's working. So we'll try to get him on.
I can just imagine doing that with a football helmet on your head. That's he's a character, that one. He's definitely worth getting on the show.
Oh, I got to get him on the show. Hopefully he can carry a conversation, because it's not always the case. So
yeah.
All right. Hey, I got to do a quick promotion here. This episode's brought to you by our listeners over at patreon.com. If you are a fan of the Fish Nerds and want to help support our show, We're hoping that all listeners give us a dollar an episode. If everybody did that, we would actually, if every listener gave a dollar an episode, $4 a month, I could make a living podcasting. I could quit my other job and just talk on a microphone. I can hire people to edit my show for me. I could pay correspondents and do all the things that this show should be doing. And maybe I could fly to Australia and go spearfishing someday if you guys would support the show. So patreon.com/fishnerds helps crowdfund the show. $4 a month is what I'm asking for. However, some people give more. If you give us $2 per episode, so it's $8 a month, I'll send you a Fish Nerds Who Rag, which will keep your neck warm as long as you're not underwater. If at $5 an episode, I'll send you a Fish Nerds Beanie. So that's $20 a month. And you don't have to contribute forever. You can do that for a while until I send your prize, and you could drop off if you want to, but I don't want you to. Or you could give at the highest level. We have two high levels to give. We have the $25 per episode level, which is our sponsorship level. And we have two people giving us that much money, which is a huge amount of money, and we appreciate it. The first one is Lopes Tax, lopestax.com. Our friend Josh Lopes is a tax accountant in Massachusetts. And if you need tax help or accounting work, go to lopestax.com. And the other one is Rich Collins from Thirst Productions. He does SEO, website management, all kinds of cool computer stuff. He's a total nerd. And he's also our fly fishing correspondent. So he works for the show for free, and he gives us money, which makes him a fish nerd's hero. And you go to thirstproductions.com or fishnerds.com, find a link and check him out. But go to patreon.com/fishnerds. Help us crowdfund our show. It's how we keep going. Show is also brought to you, as you heard, by Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, strength trainers, vegans, and more. Over half of all Health IQ customers save one-third on their life insurance. And you need life insurance if you've got a family. Make sure your kids are taken care of. My kids said if I die, they're going to buy chihuahuas. So that's how they'll spend their money. How will your kids spend your death money? Ask them. But go to healthiq.com/FNP. Find out if you qualify to save money on your life insurance. And you can take a little quiz there. Trustpilot, which is a website that tests out all these things, gives them 9.6 out of a possible 10 points. And I took the test, and they called me 30 seconds after taking the test. So be ready for a phone call, because they do want you to buy the stuff as well. But you don't have to buy it, but they want your customers. And if you can save money, why not do it? So healthiq/FNP.
Cool.
All right.
While you were chatting away there, talking about Patreon, I went and had a look at your page. It's pretty cool. If I went on and say I make a $50 donation, can I get a beanie?
Yes, but a I'll mail you one. Yeah.
Cool. All right, looks cool. I haven't looked much into the Patreon side of things, but it looks like you got a cool thing going there.
Well, you'd like it because, like, right now, if you look at there, I'm making $102 per episode. Right, so every time I make a podcast, I get $102, which helps cover all of our fees. This show costs about $250 a month to make. Plus, I want to buy better equipment and upgrade things, and microphones are expensive. So that money goes to help pay for the show, plus production costs and other things. And maybe once in a while, I'll take my wife out for dinner. Right, so all that adds up. And as an artist, which making a podcast makes you an artist, right? Because you're creating something every single week, you deserve to get paid for making things. And if you've got a listener base who likes you, saying, "Hey, if I'm losing a one show every fortnight, I don't know what a fortnight is, but that's your schedule," you can say, "Give me, you know, one Australian dollar every fortnight," and which is like, I don't know, 25 cents every 4 weeks. I have no idea what a fortnight is.
Is 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
That's a British English thing. It is a funny one. You're right.
But anyway, so you could have your fans donating money every time you produce a show for them, and they will, which is amazing. The fact that anyone gives us any money is amazing.
Yeah. It's a little bit like the Kickstarter thing, and like we were talking about earlier, it's a cool kind of way to do things. I might have to put a translation up for Fortnite. Does bi-weekly work?
It works, yeah.
Just to move on, I was wondering a little bit about the cameras that people are attaching to their fishing poles now. Do you know much about them? Have you seen the technology they're using? What do you think of it?
So I have an AquaView ice fishing camera that I can attach to my rod, and I can view the fish as I'm jigging for them through the ice. And so far, I find to take too much work to set up, and it's distraction from actually catching fish. But when you do see a fish on the screen, it's pretty amazing. Like, it's so fun. And I've had kids, I've had an underwater camera facing the fishing hook where the fish kid is fishing. And so you can watch the bait and watch the fish try to attack the bait. And I've had little kids stare at one fish for 2 hours before they finally caught the fish. And then the fish being about 2.5 inches long. So that little tiny yellow perch can keep a kid fishing for hours. It's pretty cool technology. I don't have the money right now for the really good quality cameras. So the ones I'm buying are kind of just mediocre. And I think if I had a high quality camera that wouldn't pick up all the debris and fuzz in the water, it would be really great. But every piece of dust and detritus picks up on those lenses, and it gets cloudy really quickly. So if you're not in crystal clear water, it's kind of it's a lot of effort. But they're super cool when it works.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Have you used them for? I mean, you don't need them because you're diving, but.
I mean, all of us use kind of GoPros now. You know, GoPro have just like opened up the underwater world. Now, a lot more people are curious about spearfishing and freediving because of it, I think, and scuba diving in general. It's just made the whole thing a lot more accessible for everyone. I think the new cameras that are coming up with for line fishermen and pole fishermen to use are doing kind of the same thing. Because I don't have enough patience to do line fishing. I run out of steam pretty quick.
Oh, I need to catch fish. That's why we use the technology to help find the fish faster. Let's talk about getting started with spearfishing. So let's come up with like a few. I'm brand new at spearfishing. I want to get into it. What are like five things a new Spearo has to know to jump into the to spearfishing world?
Okay,
can we distill it down? I know you have a book which we can buy, but let's
no. Cool, five cool. Tips. When I started, I had like a background with like competitive life saving and swimming and all sorts of stuff. I was kind of a water baby, so I already had kind of an advantage. And I'd spent a lot of time in diving pools, you know, holding my breath and competing against my brothers, so I had a little bit of an advantage, but. But it wasn't enough. What I realized was, you know, you've really got to learn how to hold your breath. And so many of us don't know how to do that. So, I mean, you can go online, you can go on YouTube and have a look at full breath, how to do a full breath. And, I mean, even yoga fanatics and altitude trainers and all these kind of people, athletes, are learning how to breathe properly because it's so good for your mental health and everything else. So one of the great things about spearfishing. But to learn a fast track is to do a freediving course. They teach you how to breathe. They teach you how to hold your breath, and they teach you how to do it safely.
How long can you hold your breath?
At the moment, like having not been in the water or done any training lately, probably still about 3 minutes, pretty comfortable. But you know, like back in the day, you know, a year and a half ago, over 4.5 minutes.
That's and remarkable.
I don't, compared to other guys, I'm not remarkable at all. Like when you do a little bit of training, you quickly realize, you know, it kind of just about everyone can do it, unless you've got some medical condition. It's just about relaxation and there's techniques to learn. But I was going to say the other thing is hyperventilation, you know, which is like over breathing, because the main trigger for breathing is carbon dioxide. It's not a lack of oxygen. So you've really got to learn how to breathe safely without hyperventilating, because if you flush all the carbon dioxide out of your body, your early warning systems that you need to breathe are gone, and you'll have a blackout, which is, you know, how guys die. So doing a freediving course covers heaps of these bases. So I'd say number one, do a freediving course.
Okay, got it. Number one. Number two.
All right. Number two, I would say definitely find a buddy, you know, or even a community of buddies, you know, where, you know, it's not like someone will lay out, you know, step by step everything you should do. But quite often if you're in a community, you'll get 3 steps from, you know, John, 5 steps from Roger, and 2 more steps from Sally.
Yeah, and actually Noob Spearo has a private Facebook group that people can join and be part of your community, right? And they can ask you questions and be in part of that, right?
Yeah, and the thing I like about our group now is guys are starting to like message in and say, oh, hey, is anyone live in this area? And then you get this organic conversation. They don't even want me involved. They're just like, yeah, we all dive in, you know, Florida. We're in this area here, and away they go. And even though we're an Australian-based podcast, we've got kind of listeners everywhere, so it's great. And, yeah, so that's one way to find a community. There are spearfishing clubs around. And so there are some fast ticket ways to do that, but search social media. The forums, there are some useful forums for finding a community, but that will definitely fast track your learning. Number three, I would say, you know, dive with different people and in different places. If you dive the same place every week, you'll experience the same conditions or fairly similar conditions, and you won't experience enough different situations and species to improve. And I think that can rapidly decrease your learning curve.
Yeah, just like anything else, diversity is what gets us the fastest learning, right? That's fantastic. Good.
Yeah.
Four.
I would honestly do the community thing as well before I went and bought equipment, because you don't know anything when you're starting, and we all start from the same place, so there's no shame in it. You're just starting off. So I think you need to find some reliable people to ask about what equipment you should buy for the area you're in. And I would say your local dive shop is going to be far better for that than going online and buying your gear. When you're a little bit more experienced and you know exactly what you want, you can go online and save a bit of money. But I think your local dive shops, your local spearfishing shops are your bread and butter. And I'm not talking about a general sports shop where there's no spearfishermen on staff. I'm talking about a specialist spearfishing store, because they know exactly what they're talking about. They know the area, and they'll tell you what you should buy. I did the opposite. I went in and bought a spear gun. It was cheap. And the guy said, no, trust me, buy this spear gun. It was like $100 more. But I was like, no, I just want to get started, man. I want to do it as cheap as possible, so this is what I'm going to buy. And, you know, 6-7 months later, I went back and bought the exact same spear gun he initially recommended. So I actually wasted $280 on my first spear gun.
You know, what's funny about that is we all do that with everything new we try. We always go, well, I'm going to buy that cheap one and try it out. And then 3 months later, gosh, I wish I bought a better microphone for podcasting, or I wish I bought a better recorder. Or it's the same game. I should have asked first and bought the good stuff, you know, but we never do. We never learn. We're human. We're just dumb.
Well, I think like we're blokes too. Like a lot of us are guys, and we don't really like being without any knowledge or information. That's why we don't like taking on new sports, and you know, and I think it's a bit of a bummer, really. But like I said, it's an ego thing. So I guess number five, I'd say find a consistent source of good information. There are some good blogs online. Have a look around, and listening to podcasts is a great way to learn anything. You know, whatever you're into, if you listen to a podcast and the information's in your head, it's turning over in the background. You can do it on your way to work. It's just so convenient. Like, why not? Whether it's fishing, the Fish Nerds podcast, whether it's a marketing and you're listening to a marketing podcast, whatever you like. You know, I just think find a good source of information. You know, whether it's reading or it's listening to a podcast or even videos on YouTube, there is some good stuff around. And after a while, you start to sort out what is good and what's not good. But again, like a community can help you out, kind of sifting through what's rubbish and what's not.
It's funny, you reminded me when you said that, listening to podcasts. I remember the movie The Matrix. And they plug in the back of Nero's head or whatever, they plug in and he learns karate. I always think podcasts are like that. Like I plug in my headphones, and in an hour I know about spearfishing because of the Noob Spiro podcast. Or an hour I know about, whatever topic happens to me. It's kind of amazing. Or
great
even
analogy.
Worse, I know less because of some podcasts. Or it happens as well. Because you can also plug into stupidness, which is one of my hobbies lately, is listening to dumb people. So I've been obsessed with the Flat Earth podcast lately, so that's my believe the Earth is flat, but I love listening to the backwards logic of people. So fun. I love all that junk. All right. I've put together a little fish quiz for you before we wrap the show up. I always like to kind of play little games. And I got to find my quiz here.
I'm nervous.
Oh, you should totally be. This is a real test of yours. So as you know, fish around the world have stupid names.
Yeah.
We don't, locals don't know the names of their fishes, and so they give them, they make up names that don't make any sense at all. So I'm going to read you some names of fish from the Atlantic Ocean. These are all going to be ocean fish. And I'm going to let you guess the real name of the fish.
Okay.
Okay, what species it is. And you don't have to get down to scientific names. You can just give us the common species names. And they're all fish you should know, even, and some of these fish are out your way in Australia as well, because they're pelagic, so they travel around the ocean. I just need to get that open. Here we go. All right. Just wait for my computer to load it up here. This is... All right. You ready?
Yep, far away. All right.
First one, I'll give you an easy one to start with. It's a candy striper. Candy striper.
Striped bass.
So that would be one of the, that's not it. That was a good guess. So I'll give you some choices. Red snapper, lane snapper, or striped bass, which I've already told you is wrong. So
it's a red snapper.
Or it's the lane snapper, which is a fish I don't know, but I guess they're very stripey. all right. How about chopper? A chopper, and I'll give you the multiple choice. We have a tautog, a bluefish, or a mako shark. Which one's a chopper?
It'd have to be the mako shark.
It's the bluefish.
Wow.
And in Australia, what are they called?
No idea.
Tailors.
Ah, okay. Bluefish are tailors. Ah,
yeah,
okay.
Same animal, different name. Local names, they don't make any sense. Some guy named Taylor got bit and named the fish. How about a slime eel? We have a American eel, sea lamprey, or hagfish. Slime eel.
American eel.
No, it's hagfish. Now, hagfish can produce like 5 gallons of slime per animal when you pick them up. So that's the slime eel.
Is that 0 from 3?
Yeah, you've not done well.
Okay.
But that's everyone's cool. A winner, so I'm at the end. We'll see how you do. How about this one you'll know, a crab cruncher, and this is local to Alabama. Crab cruncher. The fish is not local to Alabama, but the name is Alabama. Cobia, toadfish, or amberjack?
Must be an amberjack.
No, it's a cobia.
it's a big mullet, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's funny. I did some work last year with the Virginia Aquarium, and we were doing work with the cobias down there, and they had them trained to eat. They would hold these paddles under the water, so a yellow or a green or a striped one, and each individual cobia knew its paddle, and they'd swim up to the paddle, and they would hand feed it a crab. Yeah, in front of the paddle every time, so they could check it for lice or for parasites or whatever health issues. Pretty amazing. And
I'm
cobia in your spear world, right?
Yeah, we do. I've never speared one, but I will say, in hindsight, I'm actually a little embarrassed that I said amberjack because, you know, you can see from looking at the fish that it's not really a bottom feeder. So
we do,
and you know, I mean, your part of the world's kind of notorious for shooting cobia off the back of big bull sharks. Guys seem to love doing that, and it's crazy type of spearfishing, that's for sure.
Yeah, and they're big. They get huge. I mean, they're no joke. How about a yellow-mouthed trout? And the choice would be codfish, weakfish, or Atlantic salmon.
Weakfish,
right, which is not even in the trout family, right?
Okay.
But it is totally a weakfish, yep. How about a yodeling trout? The choice would be a spotted sea trout, a weakfish, or Atlantic croaker.
What was the name of it again?
Yodeling trout.
Let's go with the croaker one because it's got some sort of verbalizing going on there.
All right. We're going to end with that one. You got one right. You are a winner. that's the low bar the fish nerd set for winning our fish quiz is getting one question right.
Oh, well. I've probably set a new low.
Congratulations. All right. We have to wrap this up because I have to go to work. Go.
We'd like to thank our families for supporting us while we podcast, we go on fishing quests, and doing all the silly things that nerds do.
Special thanks to Shrek from the Noob Spiro podcast. You can go to noobspiro.com and check out the show. We're getting on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you happen to get your podcasts. Also, don't forget, go to fishnerds.com, click on the show notes, click through to the Kickstarter campaign, and support this book. If you like fishers and you like art and you like photos of fish or you like killing things, this is the book for you. Get on there. Give them some money. If you can't give enough money to buy a book, give them a dollar. That goes a lot farther in Australia than it does in the United States. So just give them a freaking dollar and move on. So it's all good.
Legend Clay, thanks for having me. So until next time, I've really had a great time, by the way. Follow the code of the fish nerds. Spawn early and often.
Never trust a free lunch with strings attached.
And swim against the current every chance you get. Thanks, Clay. Awesome chat.
You did it. You made a Fish Nerds podcast. Thanks for coming on. I want to. I'm going to come on your show in the future.
Yes.
In April and May, we start spearing for white suckers in New Hampshire. And so I'm going to come on and tell stories about spearing for suckerfish in New Hampshire. And I actually have some GoPro footage where I strapped a GoPro to my spear and threw it into the spawning suckers. And I was a good video I can share with you guys and tell you what that's about and talk about how to cook one of the worst tasting fish in the state. So,
yeah, cool. Maybe we can talk a little bit about fish biology and some fun stuff like that. That'll be cool.
I love it. We'll nerd it up a little bit. So, hey, thanks for coming on the show. I have to go to work. I can't chat. Good. All right. 3, 2, welcome to the Fish Nerds, a show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. I'm Clay Groves, Chief Executive Fishing Guide. I can't even get it right. I'm going to start over again.
you can be a good. I like
I'm a good. 3, 2.